Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual, and now fully recovered from that dreaded summer lurgy, coming to you from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And today I am absolutely delighted to welcome to the programme the independent journalist, photographer and peace activist Vanessa Beely, no doubt known to many of you if you've been seeking out alternative sources of information about the situation in Syria over the last few years, because Vanessa is, I'm going to say, a real journalist. She is not the kind that just sits in an armchair somewhere and hands down official stories from on high. She's somebody who actually personally visits the places that she reports on, and of course, most notably, Syria, to which she has made several fact-finding trips over the last few years to determine the truth about what is really going on, and what has been going on in that so-called Syrian civil war. So, Vanessa, thank you ever so much for joining us on The Mind Renewed.
Oh, hi, Julian. Thanks so much for having me on, and I'm glad you're feeling better.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a great relief now to be better, I can tell you. It's actually great to be speaking with you, because I've wanted to speak to you for some time, having seen your presentations and interviews on the internet and the like over the last couple of years. And, you know, it's very frustrating that we had to postpone last week. But, you know, thank you ever so much for coming back on. It's very good of you. So today, what I want to do is to kind of introduce you and your work to the TMR audience, and to get your assessment of the situation in Syria based on your own visits and your own research, but also to ask you about that organization called the White Helmets that operates there, at least ostensibly as a humanitarian organization, but we'll talk about that. And really, in connection with all that, to get your take on the extent of propaganda here in the mainstream media here in the West, which, of course, you and your colleagues addressed in the recent Media on Trial event in Leeds, which, you know, I saw some of those videos, and I'll link to that in the show notes. I'll be asking about that as well. So if all of that basically sounds okay to you, let's start with you, Vanessa, if we may. Could you tell us something about your background and, you know, how you became involved in this kind of rather unusual work?
Well, firstly, I have to say I'm not a career journalist. It's not something I've done all my life. However, my father was an eminent and fairly iconic Arabist throughout his career. He was Middle East advisor to Ernest Bevin post-Second World War. He was British ambassador to Cairo during the Suez Crisis in the late 50s. And he was actually specifically asked for in the late 60s, 67, by President Nasser to come back to Egypt then as the peace envoy, as the only British representative that was trusted by Egypt at that time. Even after he retired, he campaigned and lectured on the Palestinian cause for the rest of his life. He established the World of Islam Trust in 1976 in London to basically give an insight into Islamic culture in the UK. He died in 2001, and as a result, I inherited his confidential papers, you know, his entire life, basically, in his diaries and in his papers and his letters. And so that basically sort of set me on a journey, which first of all led me back to Cairo, actually, to go and visit his memorial tree. And from there, I decided to go to Palestine, namely Gaza. So this was in August 2012. And actually, the first time I tried to get in, it was during Ramadan, and I believe it was 16 Egyptian soldiers had been killed while breaking fast, or rather in the morning of Ramadan, and therefore the border was closed. So I didn't succeed in getting in then. However, I returned in November 2012, again actually had issues, which is fairly common at the Rafah border, at the Egyptian border crossing, and ended up going through the tunnels into Gaza. And 3 days after that, the Israeli aggression in November 2012 broke out and Israel was bombing Gaza. So I basically stayed for around a month then, and then I went back early 2013 with the intention to stay and establish a number of projects inside Gaza, primarily to help children with PTSD and basic sort of ADT-related symptoms because of the stress etc. But health reasons brought me back to France as a result.
Uh-huh. So you weren't really concentrating on the idea of being a journalist at the time?
No, I mean, I think like many activists, you know, the journalism comes as a necessity because you need to record what you see, record your experiences. So journalism then comes, I think, as a natural progression from the activism. Mm. And that is very much what has happened, not only, you know, with myself, but with a very dear colleague of mine, Eva Bartlett. Mm. You know, we've sort of progressed into the journalism quite naturally because you need to record what is happening in these places.
And you got to know Eva, was it through your work to do with Syria?
I actually met Eva at the border crossing in Rafah in 2012. In August, and then by chance we met a couple of other times in Cairo, and then through Eva, because she established the Syria Solidarity Movement in, I think it was 2013, and then she invited me to join the movement, etc., and that's when I sort of developed the interest in what was actually happening in Syria, although I had become very aware of what was happening in Syria in early 2013 when I was actually in Gaza, because then events were starting to sort of gather momentum and I started to feel very uncomfortable about the narrative that was being put out by corporate media in the West about what was actually happening in Syria, because there were too many questions at that time, but even before late 2012, but particularly early 2013, which is actually when Israel bombed Damascus. I think it was in April 2013.
You mentioned the Syria Solidarity Movement. What is the aim of that movement? I believe you're on the steering committee of that?
I was on the steering committee. Uh-huh. Both Eva and I sort of decided to become more independent. Basically, the Syria Solidarity Movement was set up to uphold international law, to defend the sovereignty of Syria, its territorial integrity, and the self-determination of its people.
I see. And that was independently organized? It wasn't something that was at the say-so of the Syrian government, was it?
No. It was an independent movement, a bringing together of like-minded activists from pretty much all over the world, actually. The majority of its members are in Canada and America, but they are all independent peace activists, journalists, commentators, analysts. None of them know we don't receive any funding of any kind from the Syrian government or the Russian government.
Right, right. Oh, you've been called a Russian troll, though. I mean,
I've been called
those things. How does that one work? So how many trips have you personally made to Syria by now?
Oh, right. Well, my first trip, I did actually try to get in 2015, and actually this slightly flies in the face of the claims that I received some sort of red carpet treatment from the Syrian government, but a number of times, at least twice, I tried to get in, and actually the visas were not given. Hmm. And then 2016, I got in with the American Peace Council delegation, that was, again, a collection of American activists. I was the only Brit that went in with them, actually. American activists from organizations like Veterans for Peace and so on, and the labor movement in the United States, Palestinian activists. So, again, it was a collection of independent activists who decided they wanted to go to Syria on a fact-finding mission and to actually see what was going on. And as a result, we met with President Assad, we met with a number of opposition leaders, we met with civil society groups, we met with various Syrian charities and ordinary Syrian people. We met with as wide a range and diverse a range of people we possibly could in a relatively short time. That was only about a week, but it was very intense.
Were you guided, though, in those meetings by some sort of official diktat from the Syrian government? You know, it can seem as if it's free to you, but was it in fact carefully choreographed?
I think, yeah, I mean, that's a legitimate question. And of course, we were a delegation and we were a relatively important delegation in the eyes of both the American organizations that had organized it, the UN, the members of the UN who were also helping organize it, and of course the Syrian government, in the sense that, yes, you know, they want to convey the other side of the story that is simply not being examined at all by corporate media in the West, by the government-aligned NGOs. I mean, the terminology NGO is so misleading because the majority of the NGOs are funded by NATO member state governments, and very obviously so. And all the think tanks and all the usual array of organizations that are working to, let's say, present a certain image of Syria and of its government. So, I mean, yes, to agree, we were a delegation. So, of course, you know, the trip was choreographed to an extent. But I would say in the interviews themselves, there was no control over what we could ask. There was no censorship of what we could ask, and there was no censorship of the answers. So we were able to ask and record any questions and any answers that were given.
But were you able to speak to a representative cross-section of the community, or were you basically led towards speaking to people who agreed with the government?
No. I mean, as I said, we were actually able to meet opposition members, for example, of the SSNP, a number of other people who were definitely not pro-Syrian government. But, you know, this, again, is a terrible misrepresentation of society in Syria. I mean, it would be insane to think that everybody in Syria supports the Syrian government or is a supporter of President Assad. Mm. But as a number of those people who do not necessarily support the government, who do want reforms, as they said to us, yes, of course we want reforms, of course we want to see changes, but we don't want to kill Syria in order to achieve those reforms and those changes and that evolution in our culture and our society. Yeah. And this is a very important message to give. You know, of course we don't only speak, you know, whenever I go, I don't only speak to people who are going to give me a positive message about the Syrian government. And people are able, I mean, for example, even among the delegation, on in our free time we could spend it wherever we wanted within Damascus. But you also have to understand, and people also have to understand this, that we're going into a war zone, and at that time Damascus was under constant mortar fire from the occupied sections of eastern Ghouta, occupied by a number of extremist and militant factions, hardly the moderate rebels. And we have to remember that over a period of 6 years, so from 2012 until 2018, and these are official figures, 11,000 civilians in the city of Damascus were killed by this mortar fire, by the explosive bullets, by the suicide attacks. 30,000 are permanently disabled, many of them amputees and many of them school children. 1,500 children killed in that period of time. And so, therefore, when you are making these trips, when you are going to interview people, you're at risk.
Yes.
And so, therefore, for a delegation that is coming in, let's say, under the protection of the Syrian government, as any country that is at war, you are under the protection of the state and the government and the army. Mm. You know, that would be exactly the same were Britain at war, were the United States at war. That is standard procedure. And so, to that extent, you know, when people say they go on these trips which are controlled or surveyed by the army, I've also been on trips like that, even as an independent journalist. But, for example, in East Aleppo, I was entering areas that had only just been liberated. So they would have been liberally booby-trapped with IEDs, with mines, as I found to my cost when I was actually in one of the districts of East Aleppo. And as I came out of the hospital that I'd just gone into, the two houses opposite exploded in front of me because someone had opened a washing machine and they booby-trapped the washing machine. Wow. So, you know, again, it's very important that people understand that we are, as individuals, as delegations, as journalists, as activists, we're entering a war zone. And therefore, I mean, I would challenge ITV, I would challenge the BBC, I would challenge Channel 4 to deny the fact that they have at times been grateful for that Syrian Arab Army security that is with them, that has actually put itself between them and the snipers, for example, in East Aleppo. So, you know, it's very important that people grasp that we're not just going into East London, you know, on a Saturday. We are going into a war zone. And as such, personally, I'm very grateful for the protection I'm given by the army when I'm going into particularly sensitive areas that are either just liberated or are under attack. I mean, a number of times I've been visiting various places, and those places themselves or close by have come under attack, and we're literally marooned there then until the attacks finish. So in answer to your question, it was to a degree organized and choreographed, as any delegation visit to any country would be, to be fair. But we were allowed to express ourselves very freely. We were allowed to ask any questions we deemed fit. And we asked some fairly, incisive questions, I would say, of everyone that we met.
You mentioned how many people have been injured and killed in Damascus, and you brought up this term, the moderate rebels, which I sensed, as you were saying, it was in inverted commas. Because I was going to ask you the question, is it even meaningful to talk about moderate rebels? I mean, when Paul Craig Roberts was on this program, he said that that is essentially a lie, that there aren't really moderates. He thinks that they are essentially all violent extremists, and that their names are changing so that it's difficult for anybody to follow this rebranding that's going on. But essentially, they are characterized by violence. Do you think that's right?
I think that is absolutely correct. I mean, I think even from the early protests, and of course, there are counter narratives to the mainstream narrative, and those are narratives from people on the ground. I've gathered testimonies, so have a number of other people who've taken the time to go to Syria, of early peaceful protests basically being hijacked by armed factions who were coming in from Turkey, from Jordan, from Lebanon. I mean, Ali Hashem, who worked for Al Jazeera, in 2012, he wanted to report armed militants crossing the borders from Lebanon and Jordan, and Al Jazeera censored it. And at that, and as a result, he resigned because he said, you know, I can't continue because I'm being forced to not tell the truth. I think it was John Rosenthal in 2016 who came out about the fact that in the early days of the conflict in Syria, he also was censored. He couldn't basically find any mainstream media to take his reports because, as he said, his facts didn't comply with those that they wanted to present to the public in the West. Going back to Jonathan Steele, who at that point was still writing for The Guardian, in 2012, he clearly demonstrated that President Assad's popularity was tremendous and that in reality there was no basis to these protests. Yes, of course, people wanted reform, but in reality, Assad actually complied to the majority of the reform demands back in 2011-2012. So the fact is that actually it was not reform that was wanted. It was regime change, and that regime change was being driven and propelled since probably, I would say, before 2006, probably 2003.
So when you say that, you mean that what was wanted, what the West in the broadest sense wanted, was regime change. But there was within the country a desire, in some segments of the country anyway, for reform. So is there therefore a grain of truth in saying that some people would be considering it a civil war, whereas in fact its violence and its magnitude is because of external forces whipping it up into what it has become?
I would say that only commentators in the West would call it a civil war. Nobody in Syria that I have spoken to would ever call it a civil war. They would call it an invasion by proxy forces that is being financed and armed and weaponized by NATO member states, by the Gulf states, and of course by Israel. If we go back to just after Syria's independence from France in 1946, if you go back through the timeline, you will see a series of interventions by the CIA into Syria, including in 1957, when I believe it was an assassination of three top military commanders, but even going forward to the late 70s, resulting in the so-called Hama massacre in 1982, which has been, again, hugely sensationalized in the West and by the Muslim Brotherhood themselves, who were and are still largely an instrument, a tool of both the UK and the US, and who, leading up to 1982, when Hafez al-Assad, Bashar al-Assad's father, had to crack down against the terrorist activities of the Muslim Brotherhood, which again included suicide bombings, it included the massacre of Syrian Arab Army cadets, it included a number of atrocities committed against Syrian civilians. So in the end, yes, there was a crackdown, against the insurgents, which was being funded again by the CIA in a number of other states. But if we come forward to, let's say, even 2003, so just as Blair and Bush were beginning their war on terror, the communiques between Bush and Blair made it very, very clear, one, their plans to destabilize Iraq, but also their plans in the future to destabilize both Iran and Syria. And those are in the communiques, the private communiques between Bush and Blair that have been exposed by the Chilcot report, for example. Going forward again, Roland Dumas, who was the French foreign minister in 2009, he was approached by members of the British government saying that they intended to finance and arm the so-called rebels in Syria in order to lead a drive towards regime change. So, the Time article in 2006, Syria in Bush's Crosshairs, which describes the arming and the financing of the opposition factions that have been determined to be against the Syrian government. I mean, this is fairly standard regime change procedure. They've pretty much adhered to it to the letter, I would say. So I would certainly not describe it as a civil war. I would describe it as an unlawful intervention via proxy military forces by NATO member states to overthrow the Syrian government, because it had become a thorn in their side for a number of reasons, to impose a puppet regime that would comply to particularly US supremacy, but also to Israel's security in the region.
Would you say that the majority of people in Syria are still backing Assad?
I would say that after almost, I think, where are we now? We're certainly 7 years, we're probably heading towards 8 years of war and terrorist invasion, sanctions, punishing economic sanctions, which again is part of the regime change textbook, to try and weaken the state in the eyes of the civilians. The destruction of infrastructure, again, both by the terrorist factions, but also by the US coalition bombing campaigns, have deliberately targeted electricity, water supply, in order, again, to weaken the state. But what I would say is you've actually seen President Assad's popularity rise. And what you've seen, in my view, from having been on the ground, is a state that has effectively, under all of those pressures, and that includes hostile media, a hostile information war being waged against it, has maintained services to its people. 7 million internally displaced have not gone to the so-called rebel-held areas. They have gone to the government-secured areas. We see, as areas are liberated, like East Aleppo, like Eastern Ghouta, we see civilians returning in droves to those areas once they're liberated from the terrorist and extremist occupation. Ghouta, we've seen already, and it's only a couple of months since the full liberation, but services are being restored. Over 100,000 civilians have gone back to Eastern Ghouta, to their homes. The government, even when I was there, so literally 24, 48 hours after liberation of certain districts, were going in. They were clearing those areas of mines. They were clearing those areas of rubble. They were beginning the rebuilding process and the cleaning up process already. Children were already back in school. Another extraordinary thing. Effectively what the state is doing, because the argument about President Assad is a reductionist argument. This is not about one man. The Syrian people are defending their way of life. They're defending their secular state. They do not want to have a government that is one degree or another of extremism, Islamic extremism. That is not what they want. And the majority of the population is Sunni. This idea that this is a civil war, that this is a sectarian war, is insane. The Syrian people are Syrian first and foremost. Their sect is secondary to that. And that is one thing that I think the NATO member states have completely underestimated about Syria. They've underestimated the strength of that unity and the power of the love that the Syrian people have for their way of life. It's one of the most progressive states in the Middle East. You know, before 2011, it was definitely one of the most progressive states in the Middle East.
Hmm. Yes, I remember Webster Tarpley being there and reporting from that and saying something very similar along those lines. And then saying, I think this was around the time when the trouble was beginning, that there were protests going on, but then there were snipers that were shooting indiscriminately, and of course that was whipping up trouble and making the whole thing into a chaotic situation, which of course had to be responded to by the state, and then, you know, becomes a justification then for saying, oh well, you know, they're cracking down, they're being, you know, they're being violent.
Well, the majority of the deaths were actually among the security forces in the first 6 months, and the security forces were not allowed to carry weapons. They could only take plastic shields and batons. And there are actually a number of videos. I recommend everybody to go to Syriana Analysis's YouTube channel. And on there, you will see a number of videos analyzing the early months of the protests and exactly what did happen. But yes, there were snipers. There were snipers who were firing at both the security forces and at civilians. But I've also seen footage of crowds of young Syrians being paid to go and protest. I mean, you know, and that is official footage. It's not something that has been created as propaganda. It's official footage. And also, of course, what was not ever reported on were the millions that took to the streets in support of President Assad. You know, our TV screens were filled with what were relatively small protests against the government, which we know were being, you know, power multiplied by militants coming in across a number of borders. I mean, in Aleppo, for example, Aleppo actually withstood all calls to so-called revolution, and that was one of the reasons that eventually it was invaded. One of the factions that invaded it, of course, was the Turkish-funded Tawhid Brigade, who came in and within the first few months had dismantled a huge number, I mean, over 3,000 factories from East Aleppo and taken them to Turkey, which is industrial theft.
Right, yeah.
But the collective punishment of the people of East Aleppo was absolutely appalling, because basically they had consistently resisted all calls to join the marches against the government, because Aleppo had largely been hugely loyal, if not, as I said, to President Assad, but to the Syrian state and to the Syrian army.
Yeah, I take your point about it's not all about President Assad, but he nevertheless is the figurehead of the government, and they've rallied around the government, as you say, because of how they've been protecting the people, etc. Yeah, that's very contrary to the reports that we get, say, from organizations like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, where, you know, I'm going to say, well, Assad is responsible. You know, the government, who they are rallying around, is apparently, so they say, responsible for mass torture in detention centers, summary executions, etc., etc. So, I mean, are those lies? Are those things going on? It doesn't seem to make sense, does it, that people would rally to a government that is treating the population so badly?
I would question how compromised are Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. Mm-hmm. Human Rights Watch, we know, was lobbying for Saudi financing some time back. It was financed by George Soros. It was a huge amount to expand its global influence. Its board of directors have consistently had a sort of revolving door with deep state, particularly in the United States. Amnesty International, I mean, if we go back to Libya, were responsible for pumping out the propaganda against Gaddafi that, of course, led to NATO intervention and the destruction of Libya. Mm-hmm. And although they retracted many of those campaigns, as, for example, Gaddafi's troops raping in Benghazi, high on Viagra, etc. Effectively, Amnesty International manufactured consent for the NATO intervention and, as I said, the destruction of Libya. If we go back to Afghanistan, again, Amnesty International were leading the manufacturing of consent with their women's rights campaigns, etc. And I would challenge Amnesty International to now show me quite how the US campaign in Afghanistan has resulted in an improvement in women's rights. Amnesty International have produced reports on Syria, but have never been inside Syria. The Saadnaya report, they pretty much retracted it because they basically agreed that, you know, they'd cobbled the report together external to Syria. And it had been seriously damaged by testimony from people like, for example, ex-British ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford, who completely deconstructed the Amnesty report within hours of it coming out, because he'd actually visited Sedmaya. But also, you know, what we need to be very aware of here is if we read the Amnesty reports, they have no context, they have no methodology, because they are created external to Syria based on the testimony of usually anonymous sources or people who have a grudge against the Syrian government for whatever reason. And even the numbers in that Amnesty report, from memory, rapidly declined when they were actually put under scrutiny. Nobody asked, for example, the residents of Sadnaya, who live close to Sadnaya prison, quite how they felt about the hardcore extremists that are inside Sadnaya prison, but who for a number of years had threatened Sadnaya itself, the monastery itself, with ethnic cleansing.
Right.
You know, I mean, this is it. We don't get any context. We don't get any balance. We don't even get any historical context to the conflict in Syria. And that, in my view, is a huge misrepresentation by a deliberate misrepresentation by the corporate media and by the aligned organizations like Amnesty International and like Human Rights Watch. I mean, Human Rights Watch, Kenneth Roth has put out a huge number of falsified reports, actually, and they've been proven to be falsified, where he's used images of Gaza to represent Aleppo, for example. That's just one example. And he's repeated images. In other words, he's used an image for one event in 2000 and whenever it was, and then repeated, recycled the image a couple of years later. There's actually a video with all of those put together.
Well, who was responsible for the Caesar report? So this was the one with the thousands of photographs that ostensibly came from those detention centres?
Yeah, I mean, the Caesar report was from memory. What I would recommend is everybody goes and reads a report by Rick Sterling, who's an activist that I worked with at Syria Solidarity Movement. And he worked on the Caesar report for a number of months, actually. And basically he did, I think it's about a 30-page report deconstructing it. But from memory, and this is from memory, I think it was commissioned by Qatar, I believe. It was either by Qatar or by Kuwait. But what I would recommend is that people do actually go and read Rick Sterling's report on this. I'm not an expert on it. I have read his report, but, you know, I have a huge amount of things in my mind and I don't always remember all the details.
Oh, absolutely.
But I would recommend reading that.
Yeah, and you would say that we have good reason then to be suspicious of that report.
I would say, yes, we have extremely good reason. I mean, if you look at when all... my point is always, if you look at the timing of all these reports, and that includes Sadnaya, that includes the Caesar report, they tend to come along with the chemical weapons attacks at a time when there are either important UN Security Council meetings going on, when there are important peace meetings happening, whether it's in Astana or in Geneva, and also when there are, because I've actually spent some time and mapped out, for example, in East Aleppo, the claims of chemical weapon attacks alongside the Syrian Arab Army advances. And they always occur as the Syrian Arab Army is making inroads into liberating specific areas, whether it's East Aleppo, whether it's Eastern Ghouta.
Do you think there's any truth to these alleged chemical weapons attacks? Over the years, there have been claimed to be quite a few of them, and they always, as you say, seem to be at the worst time for President Assad to say, yes, go on, let's let off some of these weapons which are going to bring down international condemnation against us. Do you think there's any truth to any of them?
I think they're a very convenient construct, very similar to weapons of mass destruction. Hmm. I don't think anybody can say categorically one way or the other, but what I will say is who stands to benefit. It's certainly not President Assad.
Yeah.
They always seem to come when he is gaining ground militarily.
Yes.
Russia is the guarantor of the destruction or the non-proliferation treaty between Syria and the OPCW. OPCW witnessed the destruction and has reported on the destruction of chemical weapons by President Assad. The claims in April this year, I was in Damascus, both when the alleged chemical weapon attack happened in Douma and when the Tripartite Alliance unlawfully launched their campaign of aggression against Syria in April. I was there then also, when they claimed to have hit and targeted two chemical weapon facilities that had already been cleared in March of that year by the OPCW. So, I mean,
yeah, and there's rather interestingly, I saw a report of some Western reporters walking around the rubble afterwards saying, you know, this is, we've just done this. And I was thinking, and a lot of other people were thinking as well, well, you couldn't possibly have hit an active chemical weapons facility because you'd be dead.
But also what is incredibly important to point out here is that in 2012, Nusra Front took over the only chemical factory in Aleppo, and they basically stripped it of all its materials. In 2013, there was a chemical weapon attack carried out against Syrian civilians and the Syrian Arab Army by the extremist groups, which it took 6 months for the UN to respond to. And the day that they responded and they arrived in Damascus, we're led to believe that President Assad decided that was a really good time to launch a chemical weapon attack in eastern Ghouta, just as the UN inspectors stepped off the plane. And while they had been waiting for the UN to effectively investigate a chemical weapon attack carried out by the extremist groups, in 2013, I have the archived conversations between Brown Moses, or as he's better known now, Elliot Higgins of the famous Bellingcat.
Oh, yes.
A known CIA operative, or a suspected CIA operative, Matthew
Van Dyke. I thought he was an independent journalist.
No.
That's how he's presented. I'm sure I saw a BBC documentary at one point saying this is an independent, you know, he's one of these people, the phenomena of the internet age, an independent journalist.
Well, apart from the fact that he is funded by NED and USAID, and he does have very clear connections to Atlantic Council, which of course is, you know, NATO.
Yes.
But the conversations that he had with Matthew Van Dyke is a suspected CIA operative who'd been operating in Libya and then seamlessly entered East Aleppo. And so the conversations were between him and Elliot Higgins, during which Matthew Van Dyke said, look, you know, I'll put in inverted commas, the rebels have chemical weapons and I believe they're going to use them. Serena Shim, the Press TV journalist, but a US citizen, was, we believe, targeted by Turkish intelligence agents in October 2014 after she'd reported that militants' chemical weapons were crossing the border from Turkey into the terrorist-held areas of Syria. And we know that shortly after she reported that, she received death threats. And then within, I think, 24 hours of that, her car was hit mysteriously by a lorry on her way home. Myself, I walked around Eastern Ghouta and I visited, I think, at least four or five chemical weapon facilities that were under control of the various militant factions, including Jaish al-Islam, which are the Saudi-financed extremist organization that was controlling Douma. And by the way, the British government, through the Conflict Stability and Security Funds, actually financed a company called IncoStrat to run the PR campaign for Jaish al-Islam, among a number of other so-called moderate opposition groups. Jaish al-Islam was a group who held religious minorities, such as Alawites, who were kidnapped from Adra, which is an area to the northeast of Ghouta, in 2013. And these civilians were kept underground in what was called repentance prisons. They were also put in cages and used as human shields before being executed by this group. So fundamentally, the British government has been funding the PR, just as they did, of course, previously with Hill and Knowlton, we had Bell Pottinger previously.
Oh, yes.
It appears they've run a very similar campaign to support the so-called moderate opposition. And I believe recent parliamentary questions to Alistair Brett, he admitted that they had contact with groups, for example, like Adar Sham. Now, Adar Sham has not been designated an official terrorist group, although Russia has actually been pushing for it to be designated as such. But the US or the US coalition has refused to do so, despite the fact that Adar Sham have carried out ethnic cleansing programs across Syria.
Right.
I mean, this is the extent to which the British government is embedded, or rather is financing what they call euphemistically the moderate opposition. But, you know, there is not. I would agree with Paul Craig Roberts on this. From my experience inside Syria, there is a moderate opposition, but there is not a moderate opposition that has taken up arms.
Okay, well, I want to ask you about these so-called white helmets. I know that you've done a lot of work on them, and it's one of these things that I think is quite difficult to talk about because it's as if the whole thing is deliberately set up so that it is difficult for anybody to comment upon them because, of course, they present themselves as humanitarians, and so if you're going to speak against them, of course, you're an evil person immediately, so I presume that's part of how the construct works. You obviously have a very different view of them from the mainstream. Could you share with us the general picture that you've gained of them from your research and experience?
I will try to condense it.
Okay.
Well, I mean, we are talking about, I think now it's 4 years research into this group, including, you know, extensively, and that was one of the main reasons that I wanted to spend as much time as I have done on the ground inside Syria. And I think it's very important to say that in the 85% of which is inhabited Syria, which is under government security protection, the majority of those people did not know who the white helmets were. They only know of them now because of their notoriety in Western media.
But they knew of the Syrian civil defense, which they're called.
Well, the real Syria civil defense, which unfortunately I have to call them to avoid confusion. Right. The real Syria civil defense was established in 1953 inside Syria. It is a group of volunteer paramedics, fire brigade crew members, etc. And they effectively serviced up until quite recently, up until about 2016, they were working in all areas, including the terrorist occupied or the areas that were close to terrorist encampments. But unfortunately, they came under such attack. Many of the crew members were assassinated. Many of the vehicles were targeted. And in fact, in areas like, for example, Deir ez-Zor, Raqqa, East Aleppo, the invading militant factions, and that could be ISIS, it could be Al-Qaeda, it could be a number of, quite honestly, the hundreds of splinter groups and brigades that have, you know, were marauding across Syria, who took over the real Syria civil defense bases, stole the equipment, massacred actually a huge number of the crew members, kidnapped others or forced others to continue working what then became transformed into the white helmets. So the white helmets were not actually created in Syria. They were created in Turkey and in Jordan by a British ex-military, I will be polite and say private security expert, James Le Mesurier, who had a history of working in areas of NATO intervention. And that included Kosovo, Afghanistan, Palestine, Yemen. So, you know, he had a checkered history, and lo and behold, he ends up in Istanbul just as the need for, let's say, a concept that could provide plausible deniability for the media that at that time was starting to come under serious pressure for the exposure of the propaganda against the Syrian government and against the Syrian state. So my belief is at that time it was decided, okay, now it's time to start launching the citizen activists, the citizen journalists that would be embedded with the terrorist groups and the extremist groups, and a group that will, in the words of James Le Mesurier, inspire trust, both inside Syria and external to Syria, of course. So the perception would be, you know, these are the first responders, these are the true humanitarians saving lives, etc., etc.
Which is what makes it so difficult, doesn't it, psychologically, to speak against them, although, you know.
Yes, yeah, I mean, in the beginning it was very hard. I was called all sorts of things. But basically, you know, their claim is that they are impartial, that they are neutral, that they are an NGO. Now, let's start with the NGO. This is a complete fallacy because this group is multi-million financed by almost every single one of the states that has a declared interest in regime change in Syria and that is financing the terrorist groups and arming the terrorist groups. And that includes primarily the UK government that has, through a number of direct channels like the Conflict Stability and Security Fund and through a number of intermediaries like Independent Diplomat that was set up by Colin Ross, the so-called Iraq whistleblower, and Mayday Rescue that was, of course, established by James Le Mesurier, the creator of the White Helmets, about a year later. as an NGO to funnel British financing indirectly to the White Helmets and a number of other similar operations that Mayday Rescue is running globally. So let's kind of dispense with the idea that they're an NGO, first of all.
Yes. In that, there's a very important article that you wrote about that. I think you published that towards the end of 2017, which I think is in Mint Press News, which I shall link to. And one of the things that really struck me was that you had there a link to a FOIA request that had been made from the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, which admitted that they had, the White Helmets had received £19.7 million via the Conflict Stability Security Fund. I mean, there it is in black and white.
Well, that has actually increased now. That in the last few weeks we've had another FOI, and it's now increased to 39, almost 39 million. Mm-hmm. As I say, they do try to obfuscate the funding information, so it's quite hard to determine whether that is the direct funding from the British government to the White Helmets, and whether then, in addition, there is more funding coming in from all the various, let's say, semi-private or pseudo-private funds, like the Hero Fund that's been set up by the Syria campaign that is instrumental in running the PR for the White Helmets. Now, Syria campaign was established by Ayman Asfari, a British-based Syrian oil baron who has also been exposed as funding Theresa May, the Tory government. He's been investigated by the Serious Fraud Organization, both in Italy and in the UK. So he has, obviously, clearly, a vested interest. And it is his organization, the Syria Campaign, that runs all of the marketing campaigns for the White Helmets, basically. And then, of course, on top of that, you have the funding coming in from USAID. You know, USAID was clearly set up in the 60s as an outreach agent for the CIA to, again, give the CIA plausible deniability in their infiltration projects in a number of target countries. But USAID is funding the White Helmets through Chemonix. And then you have Qatar. Qatar is funding and offering development funds. And according to the White Helmets themselves, they've recently signed a new contract with Qatar. Qatar is clearly one of the primary financiers of the terrorist groups, particularly Al-Qaeda inside Syria. So hardly an impartial financier or bankroller there. The White Helmets have a very, very overt relationship with both the US administration, with Heather Nauert recently thanking them publicly at a press briefing for the help they've given the US government. Boris Johnson has met directly with representatives of the Syria civil defense, funnily enough, just before the alleged Douma chemical attack. So, you know, as someone actually said to me, this is probably the most overt intelligence operation that we've ever seen in a target country. But then if we come on to where are they? They are embedded exclusively with the terrorist groups and predominantly with Al-Qaeda. Their closest relationship is to Al-Qaeda, to Nusra Front. In every area where you find the White Helmets, you will find them working alongside. Their buildings are alongside. The vehicles are parked alongside the Nusra Front headquarters. They share facilities. According to testimony, they facilitate executions, they facilitate torture, they facilitate all manner of oppression of any people who have remained loyal to the government. They are a sectarian organization. James Mazuria has admitted himself that they are majority Sunni, and as such, they are not impartial. He has publicly said this, by the way, but they are a sectarian organization. They've called for the extermination of Shia Muslim communities, particularly in Idlib. Publicly, they've called for the extermination of those communities. And they were present, of course, at the massacre of the civilians of Kafr Ayan Fuwa are two Shia Muslim villages that are marooned in Idlib, surrounded by a number of terrorist factions and have been under siege for now 3 years. The White Helmets were present at the dreadful suicide bombing of those evacuees from those villages in April 2017, and I was actually there the day it happened and spoke to survivors who told me that the White Helmet abducted children from the scene of the attack, and those children are still missing, by the way. 40 children are still unaccounted for. and their parents are still waiting for information, I would say, sadly, you know, I don't expect the news to be good.
So you know, the Islamists
have a history of collaborating with the terrorist factions.
Okay, so you would say that we're not looking at some rogue individuals and sort of mischaracterizing the organization because of what those rogue individuals have done. I mean, when you read that very good essay that you created, you had some embedded links to videos and the like, some of which are extremely disturbing to watch. But of course, the question goes through one's mind, you know, if you're trying to be impartial about this and to assess what's going on, you do think to yourself, well, okay, I can see there's an execution. And as soon as the execution has taken place, a couple of people with a stretcher come along and they've got the white helmet badge on. And that's deeply disturbing to see that happen. They were just there, ready, and obviously, you know, part of the setup. But you do think to yourself, is that unusual? Is that just a fluke? But from what you've been saying, that does seem to be actually characteristic of the way they behave and have been behaving for a very long time.
Well, in April 2016, the leader of the White Helmets, Raed Salah, was refused entry to the United States at Dulles Airport for his extremist connections.
Yeah.
We've identified that the majority of the White Helmet leaders are either militant members of an armed group, for example, Abdulaziz Maghribi, who was the creator of the White Helmet group inside East Aleppo, was originally a member of Nusra Front. While he was elected president of the local council, which, by the way, is also funded by the British government, the local council network is funded by the British government via a number of intermediaries, but also through the Conflict Stability and Security Fund. So while he was president of the local council, he was also leader of the White Helmets, but he was also member of Abu Amara. I mean, he's posted, you know, wonderful glorified images of himself, absolutely weighed down by weaponry, stood among Abu Amara with the Abu Amara flag. Now, Abu Amara were the protection agency for Nusra Front, so one can only imagine how brutal this particular group was. And we've identified over the time hundreds of White Helmets whose Facebook, Twitter accounts, etc., all demonstrate that they are still active armed members of extremist groups, ranging from Al-Qaeda predominantly, but to Al-Sham, Junta al-Aqsa, and, you know, a number of groups. So my answer to this is always, I don't close the door to there being some half-decent people among the White Helmets. For example, when they took over the Real Syria Civil Defense units, they did, we know that they did absorb some of those crew members. Whether they've now managed to escape or not, I don't know. I haven't managed to get that far with that investigation. But what I will say, I do not, to this day, have any evidence that any member of the White Helmets has carried out a genuine rescue or has helped civilians. So I'm not ruling it out, but personally, from my investigation, I haven't found the evidence to prove that any of them are acting as humanitarians.
Well, you've got to follow the evidence. That's certainly the case. I mean, I said to you in the email that I thought, you know, on the face of it, it would be a better propaganda ploy to have people actually within the organization doing good. But if you haven't got the evidence for it, then fair enough.
Well, of course, the one caveat to that, because I know that and I understand that people will be very surprised when I say that I don't have evidence of the White Helmets carrying out rescues, and in reality all of the civilians that I've spoken to told me that the only rescues they did carry out were of the Nusra Front and the various armed militant fighters when they came under attack. But of course people will have seen all of the videos that have been produced by the White Helmets showing them rescuing people. Many of those videos have been looked at by urban search and rescue experts that I've got in touch with. Many of the methods that they use are considered very questionable by those independent experts and analysts. And that includes actually Scott Ritter, who is the chemical weapons inspector in Iraq. He gave an interview to the Ron Paul Liberty Report, and I recommend everybody listens to his opinion of the White Helmets. And of course, you know, we can't forget the White Helmet footage has not only won an Oscar, but it's been nominated for an Oscar. There was the infamous mannequin challenge, as it was called, where we saw the White Helmets frozen in animation
let's say, and then suddenly, almost as if someone had cued the camera, jump into action, the body on the ground started screaming and writhing in pain, and the White Helmets rescued him. Now, the White Helmets themselves claimed that this was a mannequin challenge, but, I mean, a mannequin challenge is not this. A mannequin challenge is you don't move. You know, that certainly raised a lot of questions when it was effectively leaked by one of the opposition media channels.
So, I mean, what does that actually show?
Well, to me...
Seems to me, anyway, on the surface, it shows that it's easy to fake something like this.
It's very easy to fake something like this. And when you actually study the videos, there are a large number of anomalies. And, I mean, I've written about these on various occasions. But it's simply, it is more down to the testimony of civilians who, when I've spoken to them directly and said, one, they didn't know who the White Helmets were, which is an extraordinary thing when you consider how many videos they were churning out per day. You would expect them to be recognized pretty much everywhere in the areas where they occupy alongside the terrorist factions. But the majority of civilians, for example, in East Aleppo, didn't know who I meant when I said the White Helmets. When I said the civil defense, they all said, all of them, oh, you mean the Nusra Front Civil Defense.
Right.
And okay. Many civilians have spoken to me, particularly in Eastern Ghouta. They've spoken to me of staged rescues. They've spoken to me of bodies being brought and filmed and those videos being put out by the White Helmets. Now, I cannot corroborate that, obviously, but those testimonies did not vary across all the districts of Eastern Ghouta from a number of independent families, from everyone, from elderly people to mothers to, you know, I mean it just didn't vary. Mm-hmm. And the same thing in East Aleppo, I was told a number of times of the White Helmets bringing people who'd been injured or in previous attacks and then filming them and then putting that out as a recent attack, etc. So, you know, there is, according to the civilians on the ground, there was a huge amount of manipulation in the videos that were being put out by the White Helmets. So all I'm trying to say is the evidence that I have gathered from on the ground does not point to this group being a humanitarian rescue organization. It points to them being an auxiliary of the various extremist and terrorist groups. But I also have to put in the caveat that I fully understand that people in the West have been inundated with a very slick marketing campaign for this group, and that includes rescue videos, endless rescue videos.
So essentially you are saying that there is, in inverted commas, evidence for their altruistic behaviour, but that evidence is highly questionable and you have testimony and reason to back that up?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. You describe it in one of your interviews as an outsourced deep state operation.
Mm.
Outsourced was a very interesting term to use there, but also deep state, because I wonder whether you will agree with this. Does that mean that a lot of politicians in the West are actually not aware when they're, you know, they're actually saying we should increase funding to the White Helmets? Are they actually hoodwinked by this whole psychological operation, and that really it is the deep state, I suppose we would have to say a transnational deep state, that is, you know, pulling the wool over not only the populations, but also the governments?
Yes, I would to some degree agree with that, actually. And I would say, from having spoken to people, you know, within Parliament and so on, and having actually read Tim Ripley's book that he's recently published called Operation Aleppo, which covers the Russian campaign in Syria from 2015 onwards, and I thoroughly recommend it. But what was interesting that I picked up from that book is that there is a large degree of ignorance, and actually many of the MPs are reliant, of course, on mainstream media. So they're reliant upon the mainstream media narrative. Many of them drive into work listening to Radio 4, or many of them will pick up The Guardian, etc. And so that is really where their information comes from. Many of them, for whatever reason, don't have the time to investigate any further. So yes, I think you're right. I think some are simply sold on this idea that the British government is financing a genuine humanitarian organization for which there is a need inside Syria. I genuinely believe that. But this group is so instrumentalized and so politicized. I mean, effectively what it is doing is enabling intervention. It is lobbying for a no-fly zone, which we know from experience in Libya is effectively, you know, a declaration of war.
Yeah.
It is used as a lobbying group, which is not the role of a humanitarian organization.
Yeah. And they have a tremendous PR campaign, thanks to Hollywood.
Yeah.
I mean, was it the the White Helmets documentary won an Oscar? Was it last year?
The Netflix documentary, yes, it won the Oscar in 2017. The Last Men in Aleppo, which was a complete revisionist project of the history of East Aleppo, because it completely erased Nusra Front from it. Yeah, I mean, they don't exist. According to Last Men in Aleppo, there was no Nusra Front. There was only the demons in the Syrian army and the Russian army. That was it. There were no other possible flies in the ointment in East Aleppo other than that. It was a revisionist project that was nominated for an Oscar, but thankfully they didn't get it. Although, actually, my view these days is the higher they go, the further they have to fall. So as far as I'm concerned, go for it. You know, give them an Oscar, give them another Peace Prize, because honestly, it is such a mockery. I mean, what actually makes me very angry, Gillian, is this is a mockery of those who are genuine humanitarians in this world.
Yes.
And it is an absolute cynical mockery and insult to those groups. It's an insult to the Real Syria Civil Defense. It's an insult to Syrian Arab Red Crescent, who is a different, I mean, that's an international organization, but with local volunteers. But it's an insult to all of those organizations that are genuine humanitarian organizations. Even the Real White Helmets, which were set up in Argentina in 94, even they have had to put out statements distancing themselves, as they do, from the White Helmets, because you know, there is a misunderstanding there, and there's also a clear co-opting of that image, that White Helmet image, by their PR agencies.
Is there any connection between them at all?
Not that I'm aware of. I've actually been looking into that. As I said, the original White Helmets were set up in Argentina in 94. Now, interestingly, they do work in Iraq, for example, and in Lebanon, I believe, working with Syrian refugees. But they are not actually in the conflict zone. And a couple of videos that I've watched, they've actually put out statements saying, look, we understand that these White Helmets are acting as, I think they described it, as an interference tool, but we are not associated with them. We are a genuine UN agency. And I also have to say, the White Helmets themselves are not recognized by the International Civil Defense Organization in Geneva, who I spoke to directly and who told me that they do not recognize the White Helmets. The only organization inside Syria that they recognize as of their organization is the Real Syria Civil Defense. So, I mean, effectively, the only people that believe in the White Helmets are those that created them, and a public in the West who unfortunately have been completely bamboozled by an incredibly slick and very, very intense media and PR campaign.
And I think one of the most disturbing things that I heard you say in one interview was that this is a construct that is protected and is going to be rolled out in other conflicts around the world.
Well, interestingly enough, when I put out that statement, and I think that was sort of highlighted on the James Corbett report, it caused a huge degree of consternation, which usually to me means that I'm hovering over the target. When I described it as a global franchise. And in fact, the one person who got very, very, very uppity about it was Bellingcat himself, Elliot Higgins, who basically put out a tweet pretty much saying that the consequences should be made greater if there is a risk that I might get close, and this is his wording, it's not my sort of interpretation, if I get closer to another oppressive regime. So to me, that was a clear, you know, that was a clear admission that I was on target. I mean, they may not be called the White Helmets, but the concept itself, yes, I've had information given to me from Yemen, for example, that is there is a group starting up in the south, which is where the British are wanting to foment separatism, for example. We know there is a sort of, what can we say, a first responder group there now. We know that James Lemergerier of Mayday Rescue has been on a recruiting drive in Brazil fairly recently. So we know just by following their movements that I'm not far off the mark here. And I think had they had an obstacle-free run in Syria, then yes, we would have seen it being used elsewhere. I mean, we know, for example, that Iran is a target, that potentially Russia is a target, that China is a target. So you know, what better than to have the two sides of the coin under your control? You have the humanitarian unit that acts as a human shield, effectively, for the terrorist group, right? Because, you know, whenever the campaigns begin, who starts the outcry? It's the White Helmets. So it worked in East Aleppo. There were a degree of success there, because there were constant ceasefires that sort of decelerated the Syrian Arab Army advances. But I think by the time they came to Eastern Ghouta, they had learned not to be affected in the same way. And so therefore the Ghouta campaign was a lot more slick. It was a lot more efficient. And they didn't agree to ceasefires. You know, they basically said, no, this campaign has... And they knew why it had to be completed, because they knew that there were also plans for the US to move more militants from the American base in Al-Tanf to Eastern Ghouta to reinforce the militants in Eastern Ghouta to maintain their stronghold in Eastern Ghouta. So there were a number of elements that played into the speed of the liberation of Eastern Ghouta. But, it, you know, in East Aleppo, unfortunately, I think, because it did create problems for the civilians, it made it harder for them to leave by the humanitarian corridors, etc. So, you know, I stand by that. I think the White Helmets was intended to be a global franchise. I think Syria was, but I say Syria was the blueprint, but even if we go back to Kosovo, for example, and remembering that James Lemessurier was on the ground there, when we saw the KLA, which was, of course, effectively really Al-Qaeda, and again financed, according to, if you read Mark Curtis, by the British government, were then converted into the Kosovo Security Corps. So, you know, we saw a very similar transformation. There was actually an article, I think it's Georgetown University in 2015, where they compare the role of the White Helmets to that of the KLA in the Kosovo Security Corps. So it's very clear, you know, I mean, former Yugoslavia was the blueprint of all of the future interventions. And I think then that transformation, the evolution of KLA to the Kosovo Security Corps, they then evolved that into being this first responder organization. It's a very clever concept. I give them that.
Indeed. So you're predicting essentially to do with the concept rather than the White Helmets as such, because the brand has to change. And that's part of its strength if it evolves gradually over time. It's difficult to pin it down, isn't it? Yeah. To pin blame in the same way as the forces themselves change their names. Yes.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And as you say, it's very difficult to keep track. Mm. You know, I don't know how many, I can't remember how many rebrands Nusra Front has had, for example. In East Aleppo alone, there were probably around 50 different brigades. I mean, even I can't keep up with all of them. You know, I know the main ones, but the smaller ones I just can't follow because there's so many different splinter factions.
So it's difficult to keep track, and it's also difficult for you as a journalist, a researcher, to resist the accusation that you're just making things up. It's difficult for you to prove your case, I presume. That's part of the strategy.
Yeah.
You, of course, are attacked regularly in the mainstream media, particularly recently, because you've had this media on trial conference in Leeds, and I've seen some of the videos of that, which I found fascinating. Again, I'm going to link to that. Now, as a consequence of your group, including academics as well, and you say Peter Ford himself was involved with that, wasn't he? You've been attacked by various mainstream outlets, and I mentioned to you before the interview, I am going to mention the name Chris York. You didn't want me to, but I'm going to.
Oh, no, I don't mind.
You haven't read his pieces, but he writes at the Huffington Post UK, and to be honest, you know, I don't understand how anybody can read that and really take it seriously, because it is full of all the textbook attacks against people, to be honest, you know, guilt by association, etc., etc. What I want to ask you about this is whether you think that this is a sign of weakness on the part of the mainstream, that they have to do this, that not only you are onto something, but you are actually having an effect, and the only way they can fight back is not with real arguments, there's not a leg to stand on, but just by simply ad hominem attacking you. Is it a sign of weakness?
Absolutely. You know, I think as soon as anyone devolves to ad hominem, they've lost the argument. But the problem is they're effectively defending propaganda. I mean, Chris York has never been to Syria. I mean, I've had private conversations with Chris York. And my argument is, you know, we're 8 years into this war. If you have now, as a journalist, never bothered to go to Syria, and it's not as if you're struggling financially, you're employed by Huffington Post, you can apply for a visa just like any other journalist, and you will probably, you know, it will probably be given to you. You can go. and you can then engage with me, having been on the ground. But when you're sat in London, basically using, you know, the sources you're using are compromised sources anyway. I mean, they're effectively, I mean, he's spoken to James Lemessurier. Well, James Lemessurier is funded by the British government to create the White Helmets. So I'm sorry, but in my view, that's a compromised source. And then project his own compromised position onto me by saying that I'm compromised, when in fact, up until the beginning of June, when I finally set up a Patreon account, I was totally self-funded. I have no affiliation to any government. I'm not funded by any government. I finance my own trips, and my opinion is my own. Mm. And the facts that I see, I report on those facts. I mean, you mentioned the word truth at the beginning of the interview, and I have a bit of a phobia about the word truth, because I don't honestly think that anyone has the truth, Julian, because the truth is always evolving. I mean, every time I go back to Syria, I get another layer of the complexity. Sure. I get another nuance. I get another. So, yeah. You know, I don't think that search for the truth ever actually ends. I think it's a search for answers, and it's a search for facts, and it's a search for evidence. And that's what I present.
I take your point, and it's a good point, but I didn't really mean truth with a big T, as if you would find out everything about it.
No,
but that you are motivated by the desire to find out what is really going on, although you're gradually piecing it together, and that's absolutely fair enough.
Well, I think,
but
I mean,
a lot of people
I
are not.
Yeah,
but, you know, I mean, from my reading of what Chris York has written, he's not. He's trying to stop.
Yeah,
I'm going to say truth with a small T actually being spoken, because of the way he writes. That's obvious to me.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, when I say I haven't read it, I mean, I've skimmed them, but I mean, honestly, I wouldn't give it the kind of the respect that it doesn't deserve by actually spending any time looking through them. I mean, I had already decided that, you know, he was basically a stooge that had been employed to try and discredit not only my voice, but the voice of others who have also bothered to actually go to Syria as either independent activists, journalists, commentators. It doesn't matter. But the fact is that all of those people, you know, whether they've gone as part of a delegation, whether like Tulsi Gabbard, they've gone, you know, as a congressperson to actually go and see what's going on, they all pretty much come back with the same narratives as myself. It's not as if we're connected. I don't know Tulsi Gabbard. I don't know the majority of people that go to Syria independently. But they will all come back with almost identical reports. Right. And so to me, that, you know, if I were a journalist, I'd start to say, well, actually, there must be some, you know, like you said, but the problem is it's not a debate, Julian. They're not looking to debate and actually have a discussion. What they're looking to do is to suppress what you're talking about. And that is very, very clear from the censorship that we receive all the time. I'm censored by exclusion. In other words, the BBC, you know, all of the mainstream channels will not interview me. They will not give me the right to reply. When The Guardian conducted that smear piece by some tech office junior in San Francisco, I was not given the right to reply. Now, she did send me a series of questions, but I mean, they were so clearly slanted and so transparent in the direction the article was going to take. Of course, I refused to answer them. And I simply said that you're going down the route of slander. So you should be very, very careful here, because, of course, there were the usual questions. Are you funded by the Russian government, funded by the Syrian government? Yeah. That's basically what it all comes down to. One, I have too much influence on social media. Well, I thought that's what social media is about. Two, I must be funded by either Assad or Putin, because I can't possibly have this opinion without being coerced, you know, by the target for criminalization, right? I can't possibly have my own mind and my own ability to judge a situation, because, of course, they've been running a gaslight campaign for so long that they just assume everyone's going to co-opt it into it. And so there's very few journalists that will engage me in an honest debate. When I'm talking journalists, I'm talking mainstream. I can count them probably on one hand. I mean, I met, and I'm not going to give any names, but I met one prominent journalist from the BBC in Damascus. We had quite a civilized conversation, well, very civilized conversation. But I said to them, why will the BBC not report on the White Helmets and on the doubts about the White Helmets? And why are you not investigating them? And they both, do you know what they said to me? This is a journalist. They said, oh, oh, but that's too polarizing and it's too controversial.
Oh, good heavens. Not even to report on them.
No. Can't right. touch.
That's quite revealing. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, that to me was my answer. Okay, then you're just an instrument of the British state. You're not going to rock the boat as far as UK Foreign Office policy is concerned. And you're not going to tackle one of the most controversial elements that is being financed by the British. Because I said to them, but you do know that they're financed by the British government. And if nothing else, there should be an investigation into an organisation that has participated in extrajudicial executions, torture, dismemberment of prisoners of war, and celebration of the death of a number of civilians and Russian and Syrian soldiers. I said, you know, if one of these acts had been committed by a member of the Red Cross or a member of the Syrian Red Crescent, there would be outcry and there would be justifiably an investigation into that organisation.
Just before we close, I want to turn back to the general situation over there. And one of the things that I read recently, I think again in Mint Press, was that Russian intelligence was very concerned that there are going to be more false flags taking place because of the presence of the US now in the Mediterranean there near Syria. Are you personally expecting there to be more false flags and hoaxes and the like? And connected with that question, what stage are we at now with the Syrian conflict? Do you see the end in sight or do you see it flaring up?
In answer to will there be further chemical weapon events, yes, I think there's a very high likelihood of that. Yeah. And I will explain why. The Syrian army now with Russia is conducting a military campaign to liberate the south. Now, basically, Dara itself is sort of cut into two. So they've cut a channel through two areas that are occupied by Al-Qaeda and a number of groups that are controlled actually by UK military and US from Jordan. That campaign is ongoing, but of course what will happen eventually is when they tackle the western side, it's difficult to show without a map, but if you can imagine, the Syrian army has a channel through two different areas. At the moment, they're working on liberating the eastern area. When they turn to the west, of course, that brings them into almost direct confrontation with Israel, who are illegally occupying the Golan territories. So at that point, there is obviously a serious intensification point where there is potential for some sort of distraction event.
Right.
And it's no surprise, of course, that it is Britain that has pushed for the OPCW to be given the mandate to attribute blame, you know, just as these military campaigns are intensifying. But if you also look over to the northeast, as you rightly said, the states is occupying the northeast, which is effectively the richest oil fields in Syria, via not only direct troops on the ground, but British troops, French troops, and it has been rumoured that Italian troops are there, but and their chosen proxy, the SDF. Now, very recently, over 70 tribes from Aleppo, Hasaka and Raqqa. Hasaka and Raqqa are in that northeastern block, have effectively declared war against the US occupation and against the SDF. And we know that recently there have been attacks against the US positions in Al-Tanf, which is their chosen military base. The US has been bombing Iraqi troops and Syrian troops on the border at Al-Bukramel. And so there is already a sort of a degree of flare up there. Now, imagine if a chemical attack were to be carried out there, a staged attack. This would, for the first time, potentially include American or British or French troops in the chemical attack.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, yes, that's
yes, indeed.
You can kind of see where I'm going with that one. And so far, all of the chemical attack provocations that Russia has said are about to happen have all been in that northeastern area until the one, I think, today, which they said was being prepared in Idlib. But that one, the last two or three, have all been designated for the northeast. So I think, yes, we're walking on a knife edge, and at some point also, I would say there's potential for the assets on the ground to go out of control, to go, you know, off script, and to produce their own chemical attack, and then we're going to see, and then we'll see what happens. Because, of course, we can speculate that the controllers of the militant factions, the White Helmets, all the various so-called organizations on the ground affiliated to the terrorist groups have been under the control of the various NATO member states that are financing and arming them. But at some point, I believe, and this is just from what I saw in Eastern Ghouta, these assets on the ground will go out of control and they will think, well, okay, I know, but if we do a chemical attack, then they'll bomb, you know? So let's do a chemical attack, right?
Yeah, I've wondered actually if a lot of it actually has been that, you know, from the word go. I'm not saying explain it all away, but that a you know, substantial amount of it. And I wondered whether what happened in Douma, which from my reading I understood to be a hoax, you know, whether that was that kind of thing. We're desperate, let's do this, and it's going to have that kind of reaction, and it's exactly what did happen.
I would say almost certainly. I mean, I'm actually finishing off an article now based on the testimony that I received from a number of civilians in one particular area of Eastern Ghouta who actually described to me on the 6th of March that the White Helmets and the militant groups in that area had tried to stage a chemical attack. And the civilians had actually derailed it by protesting and by raising the Syrian flag. So they had to actually pull it.
Right.
But then they did another one the day later when they thought they might be clear. Right? But actually,
right.
When
so
I
a number of these are actually going on, and only some of them go through, and those are the ones we hear about.
Yeah, exactly. Interesting. So that gave me more of an insight into it's not quite as controlled or strategic as maybe we all thought before. I think it's a little bit of chaos, actually.
But you can control chaos, can't you? You can set the conditions in which this is going to happen.
You
and it
can.
Seems chaotic, but actually it's controlled. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, it's very difficult to discern which is which. And, I mean, you know, it's very hard to conclusively say what happened in any of these events. And that's what's quite extraordinary, you know, about the trial by media of the Syrian government within 24 hours. It's got to be them.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
I mean, it's like
absolutely ludicrous, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. You know? But, I mean, it's so complex, Gillian, when you're on the ground. I mean, seriously.
Right.
And that's what makes it insane. And that is why now I have no longer any tolerance of people like Chris York who issue opinions. From where? From London. I don't have any respect for that anymore. I'm sorry. If somebody's going to attack me, or attack my research, or attack the facts that I produce, or the evidence that I produce, go to Syria, because I'm no longer going to tolerate being attacked on an ad hominem basis. I mean, when I say tolerate, they'll continue doing it, but I'm taking no notice of it, because for me, it's a sign of their own failing. It's a sign of the fact that their propaganda is not working anymore, that more and more the public consensus is turning against them. And they're simply trying. But, you know, even if they shut me up by whatever method, do they honestly think there isn't going to be hundreds, if not thousands, more people questioning their narrative now?
Well, absolutely, yes. I mean, this is why I think, and I've said this a number of times on the program, is that the whole concept of the false flag does need to be, here's a pun, to be flagged up. Sorry, that's terrible. But, you know, I do actually think it is extremely important that this is talked about openly as much as possible, because I think it is one of the greatest levers of power that exist in the world today. And if as many people as possible can understand that, I mean, this is the thing we're not allowed to talk about. This is the conspiracy theory territory. But if it's blown out of the water so that everybody understands this does in fact happen, that it is in fact a military strategy, then surely it will become more and more difficult to pull this off in future. Which is why I think it's so important to talk about it, and why it's so important what you are doing, actually making this information available to people. I mean, it's often said, you know, what are the solutions about things? Well, part of the solution is actually talking about it, is actually being the alternative media so that people understand what's going on. Do you think generally that people are getting the message that these false flags are real?
I think that the chasm between the establishment media, the state media, and the people on the street is growing to a seriously dangerous proportion for mainstream media. And I think they're suddenly waking up to that fact. I think public consensus on Syria has dramatically shifted since the liberation of Aleppo, because I think what that did was to fully expose the emperor, the naked emperor, you know, the mainstream media that for 4.5 years had been running an absolutely misrepresenting campaign against the Syrian people effectively, while pretending to be talking on behalf of the Syrian people that were effectively being imprisoned and incarcerated by the terrorist and extremist groups that they were lionizing and glorifying in the West. And so I think from, I would say from the liberation of Aleppo onwards, it's been freefall for the mainstream media. I mean, to the point where now they're having to set up, what is it, monitoring organizations to try and control people's influence on Twitter. I mean, you know, it's actually quite pathetic. It's really like, you know, it's guys, you know, I mean, if they were genuinely defending an opinion, Vivian, they wouldn't be doing this kind of stuff. I mean, any normal human being must appreciate that. If somebody has an opinion, they can defend it, right? But they're not defending an opinion.
And more and more people are becoming aware of this. But one of the things I find is that there's a lot of talk on the media about this, and we're freely talking about it here, but it's the everyday conversations between people on the street and at work. And that, I still think that's where the resistance is. It's like we're sort of isolated individuals, that we obey these rules, these sort of socially engineered rules about what we can talk about, what we can't. And that is deeply concerning. We've got to get beyond that. Well, and I have admitted many times, you know, that in my own personal life, I am bound by this as well. I'm quite bad about talking about these sorts of things with friends and relatives, etc. But we have to get beyond it, don't we?
Yeah, we do. And I think that was one of the reasons that Sheila Coombs of Froom Stop War came up with the idea of Media on Trial. And we've now done 3 events, and they've been, I mean, in London, we had, I think over 600 people come, and that included members of mainstream media, including Chris York, actually.
Not converted, obviously.
No, I think he came with the sole purpose of kind of finding the chinks in our armour, which obviously he didn't quite manage to, because he reverted to ad hominem. But, you know, and I think that is very important. I think it's very important to offer people the space to come into where they can, you're quite right, where they can have... where they can talk about their doubts and they can talk about their ideas without fear of judgment.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, I talk very quickly about gaslighting, but we have effectively been gaslighted. It is very much, for me, an abuser-victim relationship between the state, the media, and the public, in the sense that we've been reduced by a number of fear factors, whether it's terrorism, whether it's national security, whether it's financial fear, you know, a number. Right, austerity, National Health Service, all of this, and in America there's even more, to the point where actually our own belief in our ability to judge a situation or to rationally, logically work out what is fact and what is fiction, what is propaganda and what is truth, you know, truth with a small t,
indeed,
has been eroded. And that's what we need to enable. I don't think I'm exaggerating, we actually need to offer people a space into which they can escape this abuser relationship, because it is abusive. What our state and what our media are doing to us is abusive. What they're doing to the people of Syria is abusive. What they're doing to the people of Yemen is abusive. What they've done to Iraq, what they did to Libya, I mean, I can keep going, was abusive in the extreme. And so, I'm not using terminology that is exaggerating or sensationalist. Yes. That is what is very important, that people do have a space into which they can come and talk.
Absolutely.
And even if their ideas are out there, even if their ideas are, you know, totally crazy, it doesn't matter, because that's what discussion is about.
That's one of the things I noticed listening to the Q&A after some of those presentations there. I actually liked that some of the people did come up with some rather odd views, but there was no condemnation of that.
Pardon? There shouldn't be.
No, but I'm saying that I was impressed by the way, you know, the speakers actually handled that.
Yeah.
You know, they managed to sort of say something like, well, that's very interesting what you say, but, and then talked about what they believe to be credible without any accusation there at all. And that's so refreshing to hear that there is that space.
Well, because many people, and this is what I'm saying, many people are trying to get themselves out of this victim status, but their ideas are not developed because, as you said, they're afraid to talk about it in the workplace or with their family. And so they kind of, you know, they almost maintain this kind of little seed of thought and of analysis inside, so they can't express it. So what we try to do is create an environment in which they can express it, and then perhaps we can put some element of understanding onto it, or other members of the audience can as well. You know, it's not only us. I mean, this is about people exchanging ideas and actually coming to a realization that they're not crazy a lot of the time in the way they're thinking. And then that's, you know, that for me was actually you're absolutely right. There was one lady that stood up and I really felt her pain. Exactly. I really felt her trying to kind of understand what is going on in this world. And it was actually quite an emotional moment because I just thought, I think this is the first time she's ever had the courage to publicly express what she's thinking. And her courage was extraordinary.
I think I know, the one you mean, actually, yes.
Yeah.
I think she put forward something that I personally would consider to be more of an extravagant theory that I would go for, but it didn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Because she was free to say it, and there was a lot of truth in what she said.
Yeah. And, you know, but it's possibly extravagant because she's never had the possibility to discuss it and then put it into context, for example, you know? And so that, you know, going forward, I think what we want to do with Media on Trial is to maybe change the format and actually make it longer and actually have proper workshops so people can break up into smaller groups and can sit down. And actually, as you said, you know, sit and discuss over a cup of coffee openly, however crazy their theories might be.
And to make it... Sorry, my toddler is making a lot of noise in the background. I thought he might, and he has done. And presumably you wish this to grow, to make it into a bigger event, because it's quite small at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's relatively small. I mean, again, we're self-financed, so, you know, it's a question of... It has to pay for itself. So until it sort of expands. I mean, the only reason the Leeds one was relatively small, we had over 200 turn up, though, was because, of course, it was heavily censored by, we believe, the British government, because it was a parliamentary advisor that had it shut down at two venues. And then we were very fortunate in that there was an Islamic centre, a Shia Islamic centre, that agreed within 3 days' notice to actually hold the event for us.
Ah, you see, it was an Islamic centre.
Yeah.
So you see, there's something that will be levelled against you, well, just like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I'm being facetious, of course.
No, I know, but I mean, well, actually, I mean, you know, the fact that it was a Shia Islamic centre. I mean, Chris York put out an extraordinarily sectarian tweet after that, which was shocking. I did actually report it. But it was still, nevertheless, even though we then had to go relatively underground and not release the location of the venue until the night before. I mean, it's just ridiculous. This is Britain, for goodness sake. And I mean, you know, and they level the accusation at Syria of being, you know, press censors and all the rest of it. And here we are kind of like, you know, having to go underground to hold.
Beautifully ironic. Yes, it is.
You know, crazy. Where are we heading? And we are heading into pretty serious censorship in the future, I think.
Yes, indeed. It is very serious stuff. Is this what you mean by the wall will fall? You're hoping that all this will fall? Is that what you mean?
Well, I mean, that was sort of the first blog that I set up from inside Gaza, actually, and of course it was related to the apartheid war.
I see, yes.
I don't actually like using apartheid because I think it reduces the crimes of the state of Israel against the Palestinian people. But yeah, I mean, initially it was related to the separation wall, but then I started to understand that actually there's an awful lot of walls that need to come down generally in order for us to be a fully informed, cognizant public that is able to, you know, to influence decisions, because we're not able to influence. As you said, I mean, even the MPs are influenced by the media, which of course is influenced by the powers that be within government.
Absolutely. I find, you know, occasionally I'm writing to my MP about various issues, all sorts really, and I'm, you know, I'm very grateful to her for the way she responds, but there's always something missing. There's always something in the way she sees what's going on that doesn't really get to the heart of it, and you know, I don't know how you get past that. There is a lot missing from the narrative that's in a lot of MPs' minds.
And to be honest, I mean, they owe us a response. Ultimately, we do employ them.
Well, that's true. okay, I mentioned your website, The Wall Will Fall. That's where you published your articles.
I published.
Is that right?
Yes, but well, no, actually, most of my articles go up at 21stcenturywire.com. But I do actually, as I said, I started a Patreon account, Vanessa Beely, on Patreon on the 1st of June because I've kind of delved into my savings for long enough and I do actually need to kind of bring in some kind of donations to keep me going. And particularly because, you know, I go to Syria or I try to go to Syria at least twice a year for an extended trip, usually about a month at a time, you know, if I can manage it with the visas and so on.
Good. Well, I will make a direct link to that.
Thank you.
If you want to help out with that. I know you're absolutely welcome. Before we actually close, could you recommend reliable information about Syria, websites, books and that sort of thing?
Sure, yeah.
As listeners will know, I do make, you know, quite a substantial notes section and it's used a lot. I keep the page separate from the actual podcast page
okay.
just to monitor that. And I know that a lot of people do look at that, so people will be very interested if you could suggest things.
Okay, yes. Well, what I can do, actually, I prepared a list when I was speaking at a university in Sweden 2 weeks ago. So I can actually add some links to that and send that over if that's helpful.
Oh, that would be brilliant. Yes, absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, but highly recommended would be Eva Bartlett, of course. Mm-hmm. Kavork Almasyan, who's a young Syrian journalist and analyst based in Germany because he's studying there. And he has a YouTube channel called Syriana Analysis. Tim Anderson, Professor Tim Anderson, The Dirty War on Syria is a fantastic sort of insight, particularly into the early protests, etc., and the early propaganda. Stephen Gowans has written a fantastic book called Washington's Long War on Syria, which examines in huge detail the context, goes into a lot of detail about the Syrian government itself, about, you know, how it was a reformist government, is a reformist government, etc. So that his is a very highly recommended resource. And there's a huge number of others. I mean, Shamin Nawani is a brilliant Lebanon-based journalist who has been covering the conflict in Syria since the beginning. And the others I'll include in the list when I send them over.
Thank you. Gosh, that's already quite a lot. So thank you very much for doing that.
Yeah,
and thank you ever so much for coming on the program as well. It's been a privilege to speak to you. So I have been looking at your work over the last couple of years or so and been very inspired by it and relieved as well to a certain extent because, you know, you see the lies on the mainstream media and you're trying to make sense of what's going on. And then somebody such as yourself who actually is researching this and going there and finding out what's going on can make sense of it for me and for other people. So I'm very grateful to you for doing that and for sharing this today. It's wonderful of you to have come on the program today and for accepting the postponement from last week. So, you know, thanks very much. And I do very much wish you, you know, safety for the future and, you know, Godspeed in everything that you do. Thanks very much, Vanessa, for coming on. It's been a pleasure to speak to you.
God bless you. Thank you so much for having me on, Julian. It's really been a real pleasure. Thank you.